I'm speaking today with Richard Childs, who is retired, and we're speaking at his flat in Pyrmont on Wednesday, the 11th of April, 2012. And we're talking for the City of Sydney Oral History Project Shelter. My name is Virginia McLeod. Richard, what year were you born?
1944.
And where were you born?
In Dulwich Hill.
Right.
Which is a western suburbs place.
And did you grow up there, or was your family living there?
No, I grew up in Ancliffe, but it was my father's home when he was a child, was Dulwich Hill.
Right.
And so I don't quite know why I got to be born there, but somebody chose the hospital that was over there.
Maybe your mother wanted to be near your father's family for support?
I don't really think so.
You didn't? No, you never know. Anyway, that's where you were born.
Yes.
So you grew up in Ancliffe?
Yes.
Tell me about your house there. What sort of a house was it?
It was a... I imagine if it was still in like it was when we lived there, it would probably be, I don't know if it would be heritage listed or not, but it certainly had an appearance to it that was characteristic, I think, of the 1920s or 30s or something. And my memory of it is that it had some really beautiful features in it, sort of the way that glass was in the doors, coloured glass in doors and things like that, but that's only looking back on it now. At the time, I don't know if it made much difference to me at all.
Was it a freestanding house?
Yes. I think, from memory, my mother used telling me that they paid, I think it was £800 for it in 1946. I think, actually, come to think of it now, I did spend the first 2 years of my life, or 3 years of my life, down in Port Kembla, where my father was stationed because he was working for the railways. And so then they moved to Ancliffe, so the first few years were down there.
But you don't remember much about Port Kembla.
I can remember the hallway in the house we lived in, and I can remember something that my mother can remember, was once picking up an egg and asking her to catch it, and I threw the egg.
and she didn't catch it.
Yes, she did, actually.
She did.
But that's all I can remember, because I can remember her howling with laughter. Good
memory, yeah. So the house in Ancliffe, so it was a freestanding house,
and did you have a backyard? A very large backyard. Mm. The backyard was probably two times bigger than the size of the land on which the house was sited.
Right. And were you an only child?
No, I've got a sister that's 2 years younger than me.
So the two of you grew up there?
Yes. Yeah.
And where did you go to school?
First.
Yeah.
At a little school just nearby. It was called the Wilson Road Public School. It was a kindergarten, basically. But that was closed down, and we all marched then down to another school that was nearby, which was on the corner of Athelstane Avenue, which interestingly enough was the street in which Vicky lived. So I went there till first class, and then my father had the bright idea that he wanted to keep up with some friends of ours who were quite well off. They had four sons, and they all went to Trinity Grammar. And so he sent me to St Andrew's School, Cathedral School, in the city. And so I had to trot off there. And I was... I became a chorister in the choir at St Andrew's. And that necessitated staying back after school every afternoon and for practice, then singing at evensong at 6 o'clock. So my day at school was quite a long one, and I had to make my own way home on the public transport to Ancliffe. And so sometimes I wouldn't be arriving home till 6 or 7. But when, for an 8-year-old boy, I think.
Started when you were 8, did you?
Yeah, yes. So I was leaving home at 8 o'clock in the morning, not getting home till. So it was quite a longish day. Right. And then during the school holidays, every second day we had to go in for breakfast for 3 hours a day. And that's something I didn't like at all. I hated having to surrender my holidays. Anyway, after about a year and a half, I don't know what had happened at school, but I came home and I remember pleading with my father to take me out of the school and send me back to a public school. And my mother and he went into a holy huddle, and then they revealed to me that they were going to accede to my request, and so I was duly transferred back to Bexley Public School. And I was awfully glad about that.
Well, you got a lot more time for yourself.
I got a lot more time, and I didn't like a private school very much. I didn't like the anything about it very much. I didn't like the kind of. It was the first time I'd ever seen boys caned, and I saw a lot of that, and they were pretty vicious in their discipline. I never saw that in public school until I got to high school and saw that again. Then, but that quite horrified me, and I never thought very much of the school teachers there either.
So, did you enjoy the singing?
Yes, I did actually. I always. That was almost like a respite. Particularly Evensong, when we used to go and have to sit in the choir stalls, and we had to dress up in the cassock and the surplice and so on, and I developed a love of choral music, sacred choral music, from as a result of that, and we were had to sing for the Queen when she came out here in 1956. And what, so that was a sort of a momentous thing to do.
But you were glad to be back in at Bexley after that?
Yes, yes. I didn't. It wasn't enough to sort of make me want to stay there. Yeah.
And where did you go to high school? Was that
Cogra High School.
Cogra, right.
Only one high school.
And was that a co-ed high school? Or
no.
Boys only?
No, it was a boys only, but it had the girls' school was right next to it. And but the twain never met. It just was not done, you know. Mind you, there were significant violations of that, but
officially it wasn't done.
Officially it wasn't done, yeah. No.
And what did you do after you left school?
After I...
Left school.
Left, I got some meetings for you. I went to work in an insurance company, which again I hated, and then I applied to work in the public service, and I got a job in the child welfare department, what was known then in those days as the child welfare department. And that's where I remained for the next 11 years and went through some training and became one of their district officers. And then as a result of that, that gave me insight into law courts and all the rest of it, because I used to have to go and prosecute parents for neglecting their children and whatnot. And then I got a promotion to another job in preparing a team of people had to, was in charge of, who looked after what we call contested adoptions. Once again, it was a legal thing. And so then I started to study law part-time. And
were you doing that at night or...?
Doing it at night and working during the day. And that's when Vicky and I were married by then. And she was doing an arts degree. So we're both going to work, then going to uni, then going to work and going to uni. And it was all a bit of a treadmill, really. But that was the reason we moved to after we got married. We lived for 2 years in Strathfield, and then for both economic reasons and also practical reasons, like being close to uni, We moved to Glebe.
Right.
And my mother nearly had apoplexy when we told her we're moving to Glebe because she regarded it as a slum in those days. It was.
Yes. What year was this then?
That was in 1972.
Right. Yes, it had a reputation.
It did. It had a significant reputation.
For being not a good place to live. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of students lived there. In Algona Avenue, that was away from, fairly far away from the student area. They lived close to the university. And, so we were just travelling from the home unit we bought in Algona Avenue, just every morning off to work. And
you're working in the city.
Mm.
You mentioned that your father worked for the railways. What did he do?
Yes. Oh, he was... all I can remember of him was he worked as the ticket seller down the Aintree Railway. And so it was whenever I was going to school, at high school. He was sometimes there and sometimes not because he worked shift work. But he was often never at home. He used to disappear quite frequently. And he was a. I think he and my mother were deeply unhappy together, and eventually he left. And, he left, I think from memory it was about. I was supposed to be sitting for my leaving certificate, and he left about 2 weeks before the exam. And he left us not in a very well off state. There was very short of money. Anyway, my mother then had to go and get a job, which in those days was, women were not treated very equally at all. And she got a job as a typist somewhere. And she worked very hard in order just to sort of keep things going and so on.
And had your father bought the house that you lived in, or was it rented?
No, he bought. They had bought it, as I mentioned, for £800.
Oh yes,
I think.
Of course you told.
And but when he left, I don't remember too much about this, but there was, in those days, getting a divorce was slightly more problematic than it is now, and anyway, it eventually all came through. But he signed the house over, I think, to my mother. So we were not left with any problems there.
So you could carry on living there.
Yes.
So now tell me, you decided to move to Glebe because it was geographically convenient to the city, and why did you choose to live in Avona Street, and where did you live?
Because it was economic, simply. I was working in the city, and we were thinking about buying a place, and we had limited funds, of course. And I was walking up. It was in Oxford Street, and I walked past a real estate agent there, and saw for sale a home unit for sale for. Was it 14,000 or 16,000? 16,000. $400 or something, I think it was, and so I went in and saw the real estate man, and then came home and had a little chat with Vicky, and we'd arranged to go and see it. And then, of course, the problem arose of having to get a mortgage, and in those days the banks wouldn't lend to a couple with their combined income on the basis of their combined income, because the woman might get pregnant, which is what we were told, you see. And so we had a few problems there, but we went out and we got a second loan, basically a second mortgage over the thing, private, on solicitor's money. So we were paying 12% interest.
Pretty high.
And in back then, inflation was running very high too. And so it was quite a struggle for a while.
Yes. And t- Tell me about the unit. Was it a new unit, a new block?
No, it had been up for quite a while. I don't know quite how long it had been up for, but it was part of that home units. The concept of home units was a relatively new one at the time, and so they were springing up in various places, usually the cheapest areas. And like Campsie, for instance, had all these dreadful blockish red brick places that were some of them were very badly built, and this one was definitely not ideally built either. The walls were only one brick thick, and you could the noise coming through the walls and from up above and so on was very annoying at times. And anyway, it was not. That's all we could afford. It was just the cheapest. That's why one of the reasons we got into that area was. Yes. Anyway, I became then the secretary of the body corporate.
How many units
13.
Were there?
13.
So was it like how many floors?
How many floors? Three floors.
And was it red brick too?
No. This was a white brick one. We were sort of. If it had been red brick, I think I would have.
You wouldn't have bought it. Okay. Yeah. And so, which floor were you on?
We were on the ground floor.
Your ground floor.
But yeah. the advantage of that was that there was 13 units there, and I think there was only three or four garages. So our garage was right underneath, and so that was a real bonus. But,
you had a car then?
We had a car, yes. We bought a car. And
how many rooms did it have?
Two bedrooms.
Mm. Yeah.
And, I mean, in many ways, we had a lot of fun there. It was because we're young, and Glebe was a pretty ramshackled, rough kind of place, but I didn't mind it. I didn't mind it, even though my mother was horror-stricken by the whole thing. But
you liked the atmosphere?
Yes. I've always liked being in cities and the inner city. I like the vibrancy, like lots of people around, and the contrasts that you can get. And you're close to all the facilities and stuff. It was close to the Opera House wasn't in existence then. Completed anyway. I used to go to lots of concerts in the town hall and other places, close to the art gallery and things like that.
And who else were living in the building? Was it other young people or?
No, mostly they were. There was a nurse who lived next door to us, whose lifestyle was very rowdy, to say the least. And a couple of occasions we had to call the police for that. Well, anyway, and then we had trouble with the old Swedish man, I think it was, upstairs, who brought in a piano, and he couldn't play very well, and this irritated me no end, because you could hear it all, you know, coming. And he wasn't amenable to reason, so. But that was the nature of the units, you know, you could hear everything. And most of the people there were older people. I can remember most of them. There was a couple there that we became friends with.
When you say older, obviously they were older than you,
yes,
but were they middle-aged and working or retired? Elderly?
I think most of them were still working. The man who with the piano was retired, or he didn't work. And then there was a Chinese lady who was in the unit. It was a bit of a problem because she, I don't know what the name of the particular syndrome is, but somebody who can't throw out newspapers. And when you ever got a glimpse into her unit, it was just full of newspapers, and she had a little sort of avenue through this pile of newspapers. We never quite knew what to do about this.
Just hope there's no fire.
Yes.
And did it have any sort of open space or rooftop space or anything like that?
No.
So it was
very cluttered.
White brick and surrounded by concrete?
Surrounded by other units.
Other units.
All so concrete,
So it would have been built probably in the 60s.
Yes, the late 60s, I
late
think.
Late 60s, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
And so how long were you there? How many years did you stay there?
We were there from 1972 through to 1978.
Mm-hmm. And then where did you move to then?
We sold the unit and we bought a house, which is an old derelict Victorian establishment that had been converted in the 1930s into four flats, basically. And it was in a dreadful state, but it was cheap. And we had some friends of ours, a couple, that we'd become friends with, whom we'd been on a trip to England with, and so we decided we'd buy it together, and so we bought that. And
so the four of you pitched in?
Yes, because it was big enough, and it was huge, actually. And but we could, I kept seeing all this Victorian grandeur in the place, and we tried to set to with a great deal of enthusiasm to bring it back to its former glory. We had underestimated what was involved in doing this, nevertheless, we sort of did it, and we stayed there until 2001.
So you're there for a long time.
Yeah,
20 years.
It took us about all of that time to even begin to get the thing to nearly a finished state where we could get it. But even then, it wasn't finished. But
Tell me how you approached it. So it was divided into four units. And there were two couples living there. So did you just rip out all the partitions and have it as open space, or did you sort of say, well, you can have these two units and we'll have these two units?
Yeah, we had to get bedrooms sorted out. I mean, that's pretty well a priority because we're all working. And so we just got that worked out first of all, and just moved from there.
So did you have bits of it that you weren't occupying at all because you were kind of doing up those rooms and other bits you were living in, or did you open it all up and then just move as need?
Sounds like you were doing the renovations
yourselves.
Yes, we were, mainly, except the things we couldn't do, like the electricals and some plumbing and things like that, all of which we, as we now know, is a problem, because some of the tradespeople took one look at this old house and they just refused to work in it. The main reason being was that all the timbers in it were hardwood, and it would burn out their tools when they were working on it, and it happened. And we had quite a number of them just point blank say they didn't want the job. And this created a bit of a problem for us.
So they wouldn't be able to drill a hole through a skirting board or something?
Well, no, the skirting boards weren't a problem. They were pure cedar.
Yeah.
But it was the beams under the floor. And so to get it all, the electricity, all the cabling done for the electricals and so on, it's a bit hard to describe. The house in its original condition, that when it had been converted into flats, they had put gas meters in each of the flats, so the whole thing had all this, there was gas pipes running all over the place, and so we had to get rid of all of that. And when we'd moved in, we thought we'd be able to put the gas on to be able to use that, but when the gas people came, they said no, they wouldn't do it because the pipes were so rusted that it was just not we'd have to get the whole thing done, you know. So we just had to press on until we found people, and the electricians gave us a terrific amount of problems. they didn't turn up, and then when they did, they'd not finish things off properly, and so on.
Mm.
So we had to get the bathrooms first. That was the first thing, and we tried to make do in a room, and Vicky's parents lent us a camping stove, so we tried to cook in that, which was really a bit of a nightmare. The local Chinese restaurant was used quite frequently. Anyway, then we set about getting the kitchen fixed up and the lounge room and everything.
So you had to dismantle. I mean, was it like a bedsit? Or had each flat have kitchen and bathroom, or shared bathroom?
It was one bathroom.
Right,
so
for the four.
Four flats shared the bathroom.
Right. And so you just renovated the existing bathroom?
Yes, we had to completely pull that apart, and we just rebuilt the whole thing.
And was it the same with the kitchen? Like, they'd all shared a kitchen?
They all had their own. Their own sink,
yeah.
And a cold water tap, and the heating, I think, came just from kettles on the gas thing, you know, gas jet. It was all pretty primitive. Yeah, these gas meters, you'd put a shilling in. I don't know how long it had been since they'd been used. I just can't imagine it. I don't know how people got by. I remember once we were pulling, there was an add-on had been put out the side, and somebody had knocked down part of the wall, and they built on this funny little outhouse. It was attached to the side of the house, and we were pulling out the cladding on the ceiling, and we started to pull it down, and all these bones fell out, and we thought, oh, what have we come across here? I think it was, we don't know what it was, but I think it was all T-bone steaks and chops. But why the bones were up there, we have no idea. Never found that out.
Do you have any other interesting discoveries under floorboards? Or?
Not much, only newspapers under, old newspapers, which are, I think the earliest one we came across was about in the 1930s, I think. But they were pretty bad shape, so we came across some old coins, old threepenny pieces, and I don't know, there were a few things. One day we got a knock on the front door, and I went to the front door, and there was a very old man, and his son had brought him along, and he said, oh, this is my father. He was really interested in this place because he used to live here, and he was the police commissioner so many decades ago, and he was just interested in what the house was like, and I was a bit stunned, and I didn't quite know what to do. I presume they wanted to have a look inside, but I didn't feel inclined to do that anyway. So we just talked for a little bit, and then they went.
So you found out no more about it.
No.
And you mentioned its Victorian glory, grandeur.
Yep.
What kind of a house was it? Was it freestanding?
No, it was freestanding on one side, and it was a terrace, big terraced house, two floors, and a long staircase. The staircase went up sort of.
Came in the front door, and
yes.
There was the staircase.
Yeah. Then the staircase folded back on itself and went up another. But the original banisters in it had all been ripped out, and big planks had been put up to make the access to the top two flats fairly private and so on. But when we started to pull these planks down, they were pure cedar. And so we sort of tried to hang on to those and tried to work out what to do with them. We eventually did find, quite some years later, an older a Scotsman who'd been a coach builder, and he used to come along on Saturday quite happily, and he built, used the cedar to build in some storage space under the stairs and so on. He did quite a good job, I'd say.
No, that was nice. How did you find him? Just
word
of mouth, or
I can't remember now. It's, he still had his Scottish accent, and I can still remember him when he was working at various things. He'd be singing away, and quite a happy sort of gentleman.
And upstairs, did it have a veranda or balcony?
It had a had a veranda out the front. We had all the wrought iron had been taken out, and fibro had been put in its place. So we had to replace all of that, and we had to replace all the flooring on the balcony.
Had it actually been closed in as a room, the balcony?
Or? I think they had started to do that, but for some reason it had stopped halfway through. So I can't quite work out what happened there, but I guess they ran out of money or something.
So did it have how many rooms upstairs?
Five rooms. And downstairs was this big lounge dining room, sort of very formal sort of thing. And then there was three more rooms downstairs.
So were they side by side, these rooms, or was it one of these long, thin terraces where you walk from front to back and the house is very long?
You did, but you didn't. You had to walk after the lounge dining room, that large area, there was what was called a breezeway there. And it was like a side entrance into the house, and you did, sort of did a dog leg and went round into the back three rooms.
And what was in those rooms? Is that your kitchen and laundry?
We made that into a dining room and a kitchen, and out the back the laundry and another bathroom.
And did it have a dunny at the end of the yard when you got
An outside one? Yes, it did. Had an outside one.
Yeah.
But we kept that, but that was attached to another. I think that had been used. The other rooms had been used there as a laundry for the units.
So it had another room next to it. And how big was the yard?
Oh, minuscule. It was not much there at all. Mm.
So you didn't get into gardening in a big way?
No. The lady we were living with, the other couple, she did. She tried fruitlessly to grow things out there. We eventually planted a tree out there.
And that grew?
That grew, yeah.
What kind of a tree?
It was just
eucalypt.
Eucalypt, which created problems for us as well, because the roots then went into the sewage. And we had to get council approval to take it down. And when we tried to take it down, when we got the council approval, so we got in the tree people, what are they called? Arborists, yes. To take it down, and so they came along with their chainsaws and all the rest of it, and a couple of the younger tenants in the flats next door were outraged that we were cutting down a tree, so they called the police, and so we had the police turn up, and by this stage bunch of people had sort of congregated around to watch the proceedings, and these young people were demanding to see the authority that we had, and so did the police. But fortunately, we had the thing, so the police just told them to all go away, and we could just finish it off.
So you were licensed to chop?
Yes. We had to, because of the sewage problems.
Mm-hmm. And did it have any front yard, or was it straight on the street?
No, it had front yard. Only a small one, but it was quite nice. It was by the time we'd sort of finished off things, it was looking quite attractive out the front.
Mm. Oh, I see. So with four of you living in the house,
big enough.
Yeah, it sounds like plenty of rooms. Yes. And how did you run sort of the whole, well, the doing the renovations and buying food? Was it like a community shared house, or was it just like two couples living pretty separately?
No, we pretty well lived, I mean, from a food point of view and everything, fairly communally. We, I mean, in reality, the other couple, they were there for between 1978 and when we moved in. We moved in on the 28th of July, 1978. And by some time in 1981, the other couple's marriage had broken up and he moved off. And which created a bit of a problem because we had to buy out his share. And that put us, set us back a bit economically again. And
did you set it up like a company with four
shares? No, we were stupid. We didn't set it up properly. No, we should have done it as tenants in common, but we didn't. We set it up as joint tenants. Mind you, there are advantages and disadvantages, mm-hmm. But I mean, look. We were young and idealistic, and at the time in the 1970s, this around Glebe and everything, this sort of thing was happening all over the place. People were sort of getting all terribly communal and so on. And in England, when we had gone to England with them, we stayed there for nearly 12 months, more than 12 months. But for half of that, we lived in a village down in Cornwall called Millbrook, and we lived with a friend. In an old 16th century workhouse. There was a whole bunch of us all living there. It was all very hippie and whatnot. And for that period of time, we became vegetarian. And I must say, I've never been healthier than when I lived there. But it was partly due to the vegetarian regime, I think, but also the fact that I had never had so much clean air. We were right on the English Channel. And we just walked an awful lot while we were there. And anyway, that's another issue completely.
And were you vegetarian when you lived in your house in Glebe? Did you keep that up?
No, not really. No. That was really the phenomenon of this rather strange hippie kind of community that we have landed into. The guy who owned it with his partner, they had two children, and he was a true yogi practitioner. At night he would sit up all night, and he was under a blanket, and you'd walk down at night to get a glass of water or something, and there he would be just sitting there, and he just meditated all night long, and a remarkable person. He was a builder. And he had the most exquisite sense of humour, and this remarkable strength about him—a capacity to get on well with people and organise people and so on. So it was great fun. But we got that taste for communal living, I guess, from that. And when we got back here, we tried to. I suppose, I don't know, we didn't try to replicate it,
but it seemed a good thing to do.
Yes, we all got on quite well there, and we were able to share things quite easily and stuff. But I suppose it was a bit easier there, because none of us were going to work over there. We were living on just about nothing. It didn't cost us anything to live there, and...
You grew your own vegetables there, didn't you?
A lot of them were, yes, a lot of them were grown. If we weren't growing our own, we were buying from, paying minimal. It was kind of barter and all sorts of things, you know.
With other people.
All terribly idealistic stuff. Mm. And it was great fun. It was. These people were devotees of the Maharaji, who was some kind of, I was regarded as a fake, but
yeah.
But they all adored him, and yeah. We went off to a couple of their meetings, and their meetings always reminded me, to my horror, I got, always got the same feeling as the church youth groups out here. And but they were full of adoration of this guy, and I just sort of went along with it. I just didn't say very much.
Yeah, inside you were cringing, were you?
Inside I was, yeah. But they yeah. made no in, they didn't insist that we I should stay around. So often myself and the other guy in his, for us was his name was my name as well, and we'd go off to the pub.
So in Glebe, when you had, well, the three of you living there, did you, you know, economically, how did it work out? You just each had a third?
We just shared it.
So when you were doing up the house, it probably took a long time because you had to sort of get enough money to do the next thing you wanted to do. Or, and was it easy to agree what you would do, you know, like, say, doing the bathroom? You know, was it a long process of negotiation, you know, well, we'll have this sort of shower or that kind of shower head and all that, or was it all fairly easy to negotiate those?
It was fairly straightforward and easy to negotiate. There was no real conflict. There was minor disagreements, like about the colour of something or something minor like that, but we could always work it out. There was nothing major about it.
And did you share a vision for the house? I mean, you said you wanted to restore it to its former glory. Did the other two feel that same feeling for the house?
No, I don't think so. I think basically they just followed what I kind of could see in it. I had all sorts of, you know, fantastic ideas about what how I was going to... We, for instance, I wanted to have the front two rooms, which I could see as being wonderful Victorian things. So I had the walls painted a deep red and painted the skirting board black and high gloss black and things like that. We put up lace curtains and all sorts of things. And these were primarily my... I think they originated from me, but they... Everyone had their own sort of little inputs into it. And it was never... It wasn't me, just me dictating, I don't think. I just always had the grand ideas for things.
And what about furniture? Did you seek out, you know, Victorian furniture to complement the house? And did you have much furniture? What had you brought from your flat?
It was whatever was in our unit was totally inappropriate for this place. But we went and we couldn't actually afford to buy the sort of furniture that I would have liked. But we got the nearest thing we could, and not a lot of it was reproduction stuff.
So there wasn't much market. I mean, what was genuine Victorian had been snapped up already, had it by then, by antique dealers or...
Or
could you still find things cheaply?
There was a couple in those days in Paddington. There were still second-hand shops that were. Paddington was not like it is now, and they were going through the same process basically, except they were a bit more advanced than Glebe was, and so we were able to buy older stuff, but we couldn't afford the proper, real antiques and so on. So we bought an old lounge suite, and it had a particular name to it. I can't remember what it was, and it was a bit of a mess. And we just stripped it all back and had it recovered, upholstered, and all the rest of it. So as you can see, there was everything was a fair bit of effort went into it.
So it was a gradual labour of love.
It ceased. To be a labour of love over a period of time became more of a chore.
So you lost that initial enthusiasm?
Yes.
How long did you maintain the enthusiasm for?
I suppose it ran out after about 10, 15 years, I suppose. Just by that stage we'd broken the back of most of it, and the rest of the chorey bit was just finishing it off and doing the bits and pieces that needed to be done, and those were the things that we kept putting off, and so eventually we thought, oh, we better get it done.
What, because you'd lost interest, or you just, they were sort of minor things and you didn't feel like spending money on
bit
it?
Bit of both.
Bit of both. And did the house have any like intrinsic features like fireplaces and...
Yes, it had five marble fireplaces in it, which had we wanted to, we could have had ripped out and sold for a fortune, but these marble fireplaces, four of them had been painted over with this dreadful lemon paint, and that's, once again, that was a bit of a nightmare trying to get it back, the marble back to its original glory, and so we eventually devised ways, we took advice and all the rest of it, and devised ways of getting the old paint off. Then of course we had the problem, because the process of getting the paint off meant that the marble was it was a bit tarnished. So we had to then try and revive the marble. And I can't remember exactly how we did it now. I think there was certain kinds of waxy substances that you could buy, and but that was hard work. We had to rub it in and then polish it and so on. It took a long time.
And the floors, you said you replaced, or were they?
We didn't
the
need
floorboards.
The floorboards were okay. They were hardwood again.
Mm. So did you have it?
We got
polished.
We got carpets.
Oh, you got carpet. Yeah.
And the floorboards out in the back section of the house, we had we covered those up and had it tiled at the back. So the back rooms downstairs were all tiled.
Mm.
But all the rooms upstairs were, with the exception of the bathroom, was carpeted.
And had the windows been left intact, or had they been replaced?
Most of them had been left intact, but they were the old, what do you call them? The pulleys.
Sash. You mean?
Yes,
the ones that go up and down?
Yes.
Sash?
Sash.
I call it sash.
Yes, yeah, whatever
English
those.
Word. Yeah.
But all of those were broken, so we had to fix all of those up. And some of the windows we actually had to replace because the wood was so rotten in them. So we had to have those pulled out and replaced. And for that, we came across an interesting pair of carpenters. They were two lesbians. And they did a terrific job. We got on quite well with them. They came around and they pulled this thing out and they recommended the woods, and they really did a good job. And another carpenter we came across was an Englishman who was a boat builder, and he replaced some French doors for us. And he worked so hard to do this. He had to pull out a big chunk of sandstone and all the rest of it, and he did a wonderful job on it. And those were the two best tradespeople we had.
Yeah.
Most of them were pretty terrible.
Mm. Well, you think the carpenters appreciated what they're working with?
Those two did. Yeah, the
yeah.
two women did, and
yeah.
the Englishman did.
Yeah. And how did you meet them? Was it again word of mouth?
I think we just found them in the newspaper.
And did it have ornate ceilings?
Not very ornate. We had to replace a lot of the cornices. They were not profoundly ornate ones in the Victorian tradition, but they were nice. They were those heavily, deeply moulded cornices.
Well, the cornices.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we had to go out and we had to buy those
profile
and chop out
the
other ones and then put them up.
And did you go into the history of the house? Did that interest you, or not really?
We picked up a bit of it along the way because it was an old systems title, as we discovered when we tried to buy it, which of course adds to the cost of the conveyancing. And I think we got told because in the old system you'd get to see the history of the deeds,
the previous owners, all the way back to the first land grant. Yeah. Yes,
It didn't really tell us anything particularly fascinating. There was nothing. There was no scandals attached to it, or profound, or no murders in the house or anything like that.
Did it give you a date for when it had been built?
Yeah, it was 1900, I think. So when I say Victorian, it's, you know,
right at the end of right the era.
Of it. Yeah, it's probably better to say Edwardian, I suppose, isn't it?
But anyway, 1900 puts it. And what about the rest of the street? Were the other houses undergoing this sort of metamorphosis?
Yes, yes. The opposite was an old historic homestead, I think you'd probably call it. It was a single story cottage thing. That the Christchurch St Lawrence, the church in the city, had owned, and they had given it to the Aborigines to set up a college there. And it was an Aboriginal college when we were living there. And that
what was it called?
Tranby.
So it was called that then?
It was its original name, I think. And Aborigines used to come from the centre of Australia or Northern Territory or wherever, and they'd come there and they'd do things like some sort of school certificates and things like that. They were often not there for very long, and very often they looked very uncomfortable. I had an interesting experience. One day we got to know some of the people that ran the place, some of the Aborigines. But some of the students would come, and some of them would be quite chatty. Others would keep their eyes down and be quite frightened. But one day I was out the front of the house, and this young Aboriginal was walking up the street, and he saw me, and he came over and he said, "Hey man, I got to do this test, and I ain't got a pen. Can you give us a pen?" So I said, "Yeah, sure." So I went inside and I got him a pen, and I came out, handed him the pen, and then he just bent down and he put his tongue out and he went for my armpits, and I thought, what on earth was he doing, you see? And then I read somewhere later that this was a sign of friendship or something amongst certain kinds of Aborigines. I've never heard of it since.
When you say went for your armpits, what do you
think? He just was going, like, licking under
really?
My armpits. Yes.
Yeah.
It was a pretty strange thing. But I did read about it subsequently, and I don't know where, I can't remember now.
But it clicked when you read about it.
Yes, yes.
And you recognised what it was. So did you have much interaction with the college? You said you knew, got to know some of the staff.
Not a terrific amount. We just got to know them. And
what, on a sort of hello basis?
Just a hello, because we'd sit up and down the street and so on. But there were some other grander houses, very grand houses at the end. There was a row of three terraces.
Number was your house?
Number 12.
12, yeah.
And the ones on the other side that were three that were on the corner of Wigram Road going up House Street, Mansfield Street, those had been done up by some people. We knew one particular couple, and they had done a beautiful job on it, and we got quite a bit of inspiration and probably a bit of knowledge from them. We'd sort of talk to them. One of those was the guy who owned the basement, Bruce Viles, and he owned the basement down there.
That's the basement in the city.
The jazz venue.
Yes.
So we knew he and his wife, and, but they were bigger houses and more substantial, and they'd been left more intact than ours had. But they had bought theirs a few years before ours, and so I guess they got them at a better price still.
before the move to houses being quite so rampant. And how did you find it living in Glebe, then you feel at home?
Yes, terrific. Yeah. I loved it. Yes.
Yeah. What did you like about it particularly?
Oh, the fact that people were not nice. They were, you know, it was a rough and tumble area. It was a mixture of people. We had a neighbour who lived a couple of doors up who worked, he was some sort of academic with Sydney University, and I don't know what, architecture or something, and he had, you know, faithfully renovated his house. It was a huge enterprise, so much so that he had actually taken off the wallpaper that had existed and worked out what its date was and all the rest of it, and had it reproduced, or, you know, and everything. I mean, he went to these incredible lengths, and Bill Evans, I think it was, and he wrote a book on it. We got to know him, and why did I mention him?
We're talking about people you knew and what you liked about.
Yes, well, yeah, sort of, he was not. He was a sort of a learned kind of guy, and in the flats next door to us was a photographer who. There was an incredible mixture of people. And on the other hand, there was always round at the Toxteth pub. There was just there were fights there all the time, drunken brawls and things like that. But
was that your local? Did you go there?
That was the local. Yes.
Yeah, and so you went there pretty. Oh,
occasionally, not too often, but it was not the most comfortable place to be. But there were the locals there where I got to know, you got to be familiar with, on a nodding hello basis, some of the old timers that were sort of lived in Glebe for, you know, time immemorial. And,
well, there's still a lot of people sitting out on their front porches of an evening when you walk down the road.
There's Dolly just up the road. She'd call me, "G'day, how are you?" She used to sit on her little chair out there and she says, "Nice day, isn't it?" She was okay. She was a funny old thing. There's quite a few people like that.
And did you, when you, you know, at weekends, did you spend most of your time at Glebe, or
Working on the house?
Yeah, I wondered. Yeah, a lot of time working on the house. So you lived in Mansfield Street for about a bit over 20 years,
yes,
and then you decided to move to Pyrmont. What triggered the move?
Well, the other lady that was living there has a very elderly mother, and she came from a Polish family. And she has an older sister who lives in England, and her elderly mother was getting needed care, really, and she lived in Newcastle. And
Newcastle, Australia.
Australia, mm. yes. And she was she really, I think she just wanted to be by herself. And yes, it was all perfectly amicable. We should just sort of have talked one time, and we're trying to sort the thing out, and she was saying what she'd like to do and all the rest of it. And so I suggested to her there's a particular place that we'd been through it on one of our trips up north, a place called Laurieton, a little fishing village, and she said how much she liked it, and we'd been back there and had a look at it, and she still liked it, and she talked to her mother about it, and her mother was a difficult old lady, and her English was dreadful. And anyway, I went with her up there to Laurieton one weekend to talk to some real estate agents, and she had a look at some houses and all the rest of it, and went to see a few. And she found one that she liked, and it was the right price and all the rest of it. And so she came home and told her mother, and and took her mother up there to see it, and they just decided to buy it. So she moved out, and so we left with this huge house, you know. And by this stage, Vicky had a lot of physical problems. She had RSI riddled throughout her body, and going up and down the stairs was a problem for her. And the housework was
because
vacuuming that place was. I had this vacuum cleaner that I used to strap on my back, and had this huge long cord, and I'd try and get through this thing. It just was really very arduous keeping the place in clean, tidy, and stuff. And we were both getting on a bit, and I've always had this passion to live in the inner city, but of course the prices were a bit beyond us, and one day we started this place was the whole of Piedmont was starting to change, and it's not like it is now. The changes here have been quite extraordinary over the last 10 years, but these units were relatively new then, so we just came and we had a look at a few, and then we decided we liked this one, and so anyway we put the other place on the market.
Were they finished when you looked at them already?
Yes. It was already owned by a guy, but he was a speculator, and he had tenants in here briefly, and anyway, we sold our house over there for quite a good price, because it was going ahead, you know, the property values were going up, and that all worked out pretty well. So we moved in over here.
And here, how many bedrooms have you got?
Two.
Mm. And what floor are you on?
This is the second floor.
Second floor, right. Mm. Yeah. So you've got a lounge, dining and... Kitchen,
bathroom, and
so what have been the big advantages of coming here?
Well, it's nowhere near as arduous to keep clean as for a start.
Quick vacuum.
Life's a lot simpler, life's a lot simpler. And we like Asian food a lot, particularly Thai food. And we have friends who own a Thai restaurant around the corner, and I think we've got about 8 Thai restaurants around here. I don't know, that's a huge number of them anyway. But we eat out quite frequently, and I walk. I love walking, and I walk into the and because of my feeling of comfort amongst Asian people, I usually walk into Dixon Street just about every day, and just wander about there. I feel much more comfortable amongst Asian people than anybody else, I think. So I don't know why that is.
Well, has that always been so, or because you spent time in Thailand? Is it since then, or?
I think it's since I spent time in Thailand. Yeah.
How long were you in Thailand?
We've been there quite a few times, but we the longest period of time we spent was actually in Cambodia, but that was because Vicky was helping out in a school there, and she enjoyed that. She liked being amongst children and stuff, and but we have our Thai friends. The first time we went there, this Thai friend of ours had invited us over, and so we went. She said, "Would you come with me?" And we just leapt at it, because she's a village girl, comes from Isan. I don't really know.
No,
what that
where's
is.
That? Mm.
That's the eastern part of Thailand. It's very distinctive. It's got a distinctive culture. It has a big Lao influence there. And she speaks Lao and Thai as well. But she invited us to go up and stay with her family up near, in a place called Nakhon Phanom. The village is about half an hour out of the main city. And that was just a marvellous experience.
How long did you stay there?
We stayed there for about 2 weeks, and we've been back since, and we, by ourselves, Vicky and I went back and stayed with her aunt and uncle, and we met the whole family. It's a huge family, and there's just too much I can say about all that. But you want to get back to
for you, that's an important part of being here.
Yes,
that you feel comfortable. I mean, there's lots of Thai. Did you know the Thai restaurant people before you moved here, or you've come to?
I knew this lady before. But she doesn't run a restaurant or anything. But as a result of that, we sort of we started going to a couple of the Thai restaurants around here. But this couple, two women, run the local one here, and they've been there for 7 years, been working there, and they just had this last Easter. They, for the first time in 7 years, they had 2 days off.
Hard work.
They do lunch and dinner every day of the week. You know, not they don't do lunch on weekends, we've met her parents have come out here now, and we met them.
Do they live locally?
Yeah,
they do.
When they were buying a unit, they asked us to come along to the auction and to sort of help out for us.
Mm.
And so we've become quite close friends with them. When her parents came out, we hired a mini bus and drove them and these two and a whole bunch of the staff up to the Hunter Valley.
Showed them around.
A real hoot.
And what about actually in the apartment block? Because it's quite a big one, isn't it? 108 apartments. Mm. Do you know many people in the block?
No, not really.
Is there any kind of common area that people get together in?
Or? No, not really. There is a common area. There's the courtyard down there, and it's got a sort of a barbecue thing there, but nobody uses it. And there's the rooftop. It's also got a common area barbecue up there. It's very nice up there. We've got a beautiful view over the city and everything. Some people use it.
Do you use it, the rooftop?
No, not really. I've been up there occasionally, it's a funny business living in apartment. You think all these people around here, and you scarcely get to know anybody. It's a fairly transient population, really, and the bulk of the units here are owned by investors, and they put tenants in, and tenants come and go all the time, and. We probably got to know the managing agent better than anybody else in the place. But that doesn't bother me. I like the anonymity of the city, and I don't have any trouble finding people I like to be friends with. I don't live here in order to be to get close enough to make friends. You know what I mean?
Yes. That wasn't a reason for moving here.
No.
And what about the maybe adverse or other adverse things about living in an apartment,
right in the city?
What do you
think? Well, as I just said, tenants behave usually, it's a generalisation I know, but they usually do behave differently to owner-occupiers. And we do have a lot of issues with behaviour of them.
Is it noise or...?
It's noise. Noise is probably one of the biggest factors that, you know, we have to face here. It's noise, pets and smoking. We just had an annual general meeting here, and one of the members of the body corporate put on in the agenda. He wanted to pass a bylaw preventing people from smoking inside their units if it intruded into other people's units. Now, normally when we have an AGM every year, which you've got to have, they can never get a quorum. Nobody turns up. But because most of the people are investors, they don't live here themselves, and they saw this on the agenda, they could see that this was going to, if it was passed, was going to narrow down the pool of people that could be their tenants. So it was a one hell of a meeting, you know. And anyway, it got passed. So we now have a slightly watered down version of it, but it's nevertheless it's there. It's if anybody's smoking gets into your unit, then you can.
So this was possibly people smoking on balconies and then wafts up.
The man who there's been quite a few law cases. This particular man is. Just over there in the courtyard, and he had a son who was an asthmatic, and the guy under him was smoking all the time, and it was coming in there and it was creating problems. Mm-hmm. He actually took it to court and won the court case, but as he was saying, the guy moved out, so a new tenant comes in, you've got to fight the case all over again. So it gets a bit. So if we passed a bylaw now, then if it happens. We've got the power to do something about it.
Are you on the body corporate committee or not?
I'm not in the executive committee, but I'm on the body corporate.
No, I just remembered you said you were in your first block of units. I thought maybe you'd picked up that was enough. Was it hard work?
Yes, it is. At everybody's beck and call, and every single thing you try and do is, there was only 13 units. There was always 13 different points of view, and you know, we think the question time in Parliament House is.
But it was much worse than Vane.
No, I'm just saying we had it easy, I think, compared to them. But yes, I think that's probably the biggest problem political problem. You know, how do you get on with people with. But the difference between somebody who is investing in a place and putting tenants in and somebody who's an owner-occupier, the different expectations are there. I mean, to us it's our life. To them it's just money, profit. And
what about when you were living in Mansfield Street? Did you have an issue with noise and those things?
Yeah. I would say that's probably the biggest thing that is an issue is noise. Mm. We've got quite a few pubs here. What went up in the corner here, we've had lots of trouble with noise just coming from the pub alone, just music and so on. But the city council has just strengthened their the powers that their rangers have.
Yeah,
and associated with noise is the noise of pets.
Barking dogs,
yes. And since, you know, our Lord Mayor is a dog lover, and she's kind of been, I'm not complaining about this, but she's been sort of saying that it's good for people's health, particularly old people, which I'm sure it is. But it is creating one hell of a problem for people in apartment blocks like this. We've got a problem here. We have had a problem here. We've had to pass by law again, stopping people from having pets in the units, or limiting the people having pets here. But yeah, I mean, you can hear one.
I can just hear a dog barking
but once,
now.
Once they start, it sets off all the rest. And we've got a supermarket opened up over there just recently, and now people are coming there, and of course there's a growing number of people owning cute little dogs, poodles and things like that, and they tie them up out the front, and there might be three or four of them all tied together, and they all, of course, they get lonely, and people are inside the the supermarket. So the barking starts, and that sets off the neighbours, and you know, just so that's.
Yeah. So in Glebe, were there was the noise from the nearby pub? You mentioned the pub, or was that far enough away?
That was far enough away.
Yeah. And so what was the noise? Was just people's music, or?
Yes, it was next door neighbours. There was flats next door, and they were right, very up very close to our windows and stuff. And we used to get on all right with the neighbours, but every now and then there were some that, as always happens, there are some people just you can't for some reason. You know, that I always used to find it funny if you'd go and say something, you'd say, you know, excuse me, I don't like to interrupt or anything, but the noise is coming through to our place. Most people have been quite good, and they've said, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I'll switch it down, and there's no problem. But then you get these funny things like, oh, nobody else has complained. Well, I'm here, I'm the first person.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Anyway, that's you know, just part and parcel of living here, I suppose. And then we get associated with noise that sometimes late at night you get. We've got a dead end street here, and kids come home at 11 o'clock and they'll park their car out and they're drunk or something, and they just turn their music up in the car, wind the windows down.
Have a party on the street, yeah. So, having lived both in a house and an apartment, do you feel equally at home at the times that you were there? Did you feel equally at home in either place? You know, or would you look back now and say, oh, I feel like if I think of my home, I think of Mansfield Street or my childhood home? Or
no, I think of here.
You think of here?
Yes. Yeah. I don't sort of look. What you mean is, if I do, I sort of wonder.
Well, sometimes people, you know, for them, if they think of a home, they think perhaps of the place they grew up as a child, or they think of the home. You know, it might have been for you. It might have been the first home you had as a married person, or it might be, you know, the house that you spent so much time and energy on renovating. Or it might be here and now.
I think it's here and now.
It's here and now.
I don't sort of hanker after something that's happened in the past.
And what is it, apart from, you know, you chose the flat, are there things in your house that make you feel at home, you know, belongings that you particularly like to have?
Oh, yes, there's my belongings with my books.
Your books.
Books and my music collection. You know, Vicky and I listen to a lot of music, and we're a bit odd like that. We don't watch television very much, and we're more inclined to sit down here and with the lights off and look out at the sky, which can be very nice, and listen to an opera or something and have red wine.
Why not?
Yes.
Sounds good.
Yes, I think it's that. I think the thing I like about being here is that it's light, easy to keep. It's close to everything that we enjoy, and we're surrounded by. It's rather a beautiful area. There's lots of parks and so on. And not that I'm terrifically, you know, I don't rush off to parks and spend my time there, but usually nowadays, because it's usually full of dogs. And I'm getting a bit sick of dogs sort of crapping all over the place and barking.
But you appreciate that, you get a feeling of space, and even though the city's built up, if you have parks, is that what you're saying? It gives a feeling of openness too.
I've got no. Even in places like Phnom Penh and Bangkok, I have no trouble with all the. I mean, they've got some big pollution problems and stuff there, and but there's something I used to just get out and I just walk, and I just loved being amongst all that crazy, even despite all the pollution, you know. It was just that the people just always, and my problem is that I'm an inveterate looker of things, which gets me into trouble occasionally. I, you know, just constantly looking, and I enjoy people's faces, and I'm always thinking of drawing them, and I think that, you know, and of course in Bangkok, one of the problems, if you, as our two Thai lady friends say, if you look at somebody in Bangkok, they think you want something. So you've got to be sort of
ready to just repost and say yes. No. Yeah. But also, I mean, I can see you're an artist and you do a lot of painting. So is it that you like walking around the city inspires you in that
way?
Yeah.
It's the people. I mean, the people in the context of what they're doing, I just find it's so funny. And so they do funny things, and they say, I mean, I'm funny too, I guess, to other people. I must look really weird. And I love going into Chinatown, where the Oriental people are all busy about their own little things, and they seem to be totally unselfconscious about what they're doing, and they're always working at something. They're very busy people.
It's very alive.
Very alive, yes. Mm. I'm visually familiar with a whole bunch of people in there. I know the delivery men and the, you know, who run around carrying things and whatnot. You just know them by sight. And some of the ladies who are cooks and having their lunch out of a bowl of noodles. it just fascinates me, the whole thing. It's like a beautiful free performance. Yeah.
Richard, where do you do your painting? And you know, you've got a lot of painting here, and do you do it in the apartment, or is it too small?
It's too small, and the smells are too toxic, and Vicky is very sensitive to things like that. But I lost my studio about a year and a half ago, and my former landlady moved to Melbourne, took the business there.
What did she have, an old...
She had a three-storey house.
Right.
And a rooftop. Mm-hmm. And she used to let me have the bottom section of her house, which I think she could have used as a garage if she wanted to. And so I just worked there. That was.
And whereabouts was this, in Piemont?
In Glebe. Just about 10 minutes walk from here, just across the park. It was a nice walk. Mm. And it was very convenient, and she was very, very good. We got on well, and she used to like it, because of the nature of her business, she used to like having a lot of my paintings all hanging around on the walls downstairs. So when she used to have customers or people she was doing business with coming through there, to her was a good way of
like a smart reception for you.
Yeah.
So, is there anywhere else now around here where you can?
No. I've been looking, but just about 10 years ago, there used to be still quite a few artists working around here. But since the place has become gentrified, they've sort of gone.
There are no little warehouses going cheap.
No, nothing's cheap.
No garages, probably. Yeah.
And the other, I used to work in another studio over in. It was a kind of a commune studio where we used to do light drawing and things. It was a cooperative over in Alexandria, and. But the same thing happened there. This was run by an elderly lady who was the daughter of an ex-Governor General, I think, and but she never used to like that to be known. But I think she was given an Order of Australia while we were there, and she was just embarrassed by it.
But, she kept quiet.
Yes,
yeah.
But she was a lovely person, and but she owned this thing we used to use as a studio, and that was terrific. We used to do that 5 days a week. It was operating, and whenever you wanted to, you just go along and dob in some money for the cost of the model and so on, and you could just practice your drawing there. And but the inevitable happened, as happens everywhere. It got bought out by a developer. Now stands on a block of flats, block of units.
Gone.
Yeah. And yes.
So you haven't managed to seek out any other...
No, I haven't managed to seek out something. And besides that, one of the fourth last painting I did, I was doing an experimental thing. I was doing a painting had the canvas on the floor, Jackson Pollock style, and I was doing a kind of this abstract expressionist thing, gestural painting thing, just as a matter of interest more than anything else. But as frequently happens when you do these things just as a matter of interest, I got completely absorbed in the whole, the way this was all turning out and what was happening. And I realised that I'd been bending over this thing and walking around it with brushes and stuff and making a hell of a mess, but I'd been doing it for about 4.5 hours, and when I stood up, I just realised that I'd done some damage in the back, in my back. But then, being a person who forgets things like that very quickly, I then went and started on another one a couple of days later, only to repeat the entire thing. And so since then I've had this problem with my back, and that's a limiting factor in painting, because you're lifting and standing a lot. So that's a little problem. But at 67, I suppose.
You just have to be careful of your back.
Yes.
Have to work on an easel again.
Yes, doing all these exercises for it.
I meant to ask, when you retired, had you moved here already when you retired? But were you working in the city still when you were working? Well, you said you'd moved to Glebe and it was near to your work, and I just wondered if
back in 1970.
Yeah, but did you continue to work in the...
No. When we went to England, we both resigned from our jobs. And
were you working in the city or when you came back? Or
no, I wasn't. Vicky did. She was always... She'd been working around computers ever since they first started in the early 70s.
Yeah,
so she's grown up with them, and she just... a computer is just an extension of her.
Well, and a paintbrush is an extension of you.
That's right.
Anyway, it sounds as though it's worked out well for you living here on the whole.
And
you feel at home.
I wouldn't easily move anywhere else. My mother is a country dweller. This is always a source of jibes between the two of us. She doesn't know how I can stand living in a place like this. And I say, I don't know how you stand from living in a place like that, Sleepy Hollow down.
Yeah.
Mitigon.
So
all very pretty and nice to look at and drive through, but to live in there. Yes.
Oh, well, that's good. It's good for you here, and you like the city. Well, thanks very much. You just thought of a PS that you'd forgotten to mention.
Forgotten about the rather nice swimming pool we have downstairs, which is... Once again, it's scarcely used by anybody, but when we first moved here, I used to swim every day down there, which got me terribly fit. But as invariably happens, you know, I started to miss out in a few days, and other things started to sort of cram in, and so I don't use it as much as I should anymore.
And do you usually have it to yourself when you're there? Or?
Generally speaking, yeah. Usually it's to ourselves. It's funny, there's a gymnasium down there. I think there's quite a few of the younger people who are usually tenants and stuff will use that. But once again, they like to have very loud music going while they're doing that sort of thing.
So. And have you ever had a barbecue on the roof? Or?
Never.
No.
No. Barbecues are not really that kind of thing. No.
I just wondered, as you mentioned that, as
no,
a
no.
common area. Yeah.
No.
Well, thank you again, Richard.
Okay.